This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Safe. For me, what that looked like was a parent who was coming and going a number of times in my very young childhood, and also then emotional and some physical and sexual abuse as a child. And that really shaped how I interacted with the world. And I remember as a child feeling more and more distant from what was happening around me, sort of like I was in a little bubble. That just got worse as I became a teenager and all the other things that happen when you are becoming a teenager and trying to form your identity and figure out how you fit in the world started really making things harder, just harder for me to move through my days. And so when I was a mid-teenager, I think 16 is when I first ended up in a clinician's office. And after all this trauma, I had someone saying to me, so you have a disease. You have something wrong with your brain. You have a chemical imbalance, just like diabetes, that line that so many of us have heard either for ourselves or on TV. And this is something you need medication for and will be with you for the rest of your life. And the funny thing is, in the moment, it almost felt vaguely positive, like I had some sort of answer, and I believed them. But as time wore on and I got more diagnoses, and then I'm in my early 20s, and I have at least 6 diagnoses by that point, I realized that they had no more of the answer than I had managed to figure out at that point in my life, but that what they were doing was making things worse.
What were some of the things that you were going through that brought you to wanting to get help and ending up getting these diagnoses?
I, at that point in my teenage years, was having trouble leaving my room. In fact, there was a point at which in my later teen years, I was living in an apartment. I was in college at that point, and I just stopped being able to leave the living room of this apartment that I was living in. I couldn't even go in the bedroom. You know, sometimes if you've worked in the system, you've heard of people being sectioned or hospitalized because their apartment has gotten so condemnable. And I think my apartment was probably worse, but I didn't have people looking in on me. But I could tell it wasn't working, and I got kicked out of college because I couldn't leave to go to classes. And I was self-injuring, cutting, burning, and experimenting with a number of other ways of coping that were working in their way, but were not leaving me feeling very good.
So you ended up leaving college because of that?
Yes. And I mean, not by choice. There was a part of me that really wanted to do it. It was really attached to my identity of, you know, feeling like I was a successful person making my way through college. And I just, you know, again, that feeling of distance that I mentioned earlier in my childhood of just getting further and further away from people as if I were kind of floating above my reality at some points was becoming much more frequent.
So the protective measures that you take end up themselves becoming a problem in a sense.
Yeah, well, I think that's very true of a lot of people, whether it's around substance abuse or self-harming or, you know, any food. There's so many different things that many of us do to kind of cope with our pain, and they work until they stop working. But at some point, often they do stop working.
And when did you end up in the hospital?
There was a point after I got kicked out of college that I started going back and forth between Massachusetts and Florida and driving all night. I'm sure I would have earned myself another label had people been paying attention, but I ultimately moved to Florida, and that's when I got the diagnosis that really made me realize the system had no idea what they were talking about, which is borderline. I ended up back in a clinician's office, and that was also the time that they started hospitalizing me.
Borderline personality disorder. What was it that was so upsetting to you about that particular diagnosis?
The borderline personality disorder is basically saying all these things boil down to there's something wrong fundamentally with who you are and who you've become, and there's something wrong with your personality. I think that fundamental way, it's really destructive.
It's a very dehumanizing diagnosis, very sexist too. It's really mostly directed at women. Why did you realize that that was not right and it was a negative thing for you?
I had just done enough thinking at that point in my life to figure out that these diagnoses were not leading me to a helpful place. You know, so if you think about it, I started when I was 16 getting these diagnoses thinking maybe it would be helpful. And then 5-6 years later, I'm getting more diagnoses and more treatment, so to speak, and it's not helping. I'm doing worse than I was, and it's starting to sound pretty insulting and basically telling me at my core that I'm wrong, that it's all about me. And I just, you know, there was some point at which I thought, you know, there's a lot that's happened in my life and no one's even asking me about what happened to me and why I do these things. Why do I cut? Why do I burn? What does it mean to me? No one's asking those questions. So it became too suspect for me to ignore at that point.
And when you got the borderline diagnosis, was that part of when you entered into the hospital or?
Right. So I got the borderline diagnosis because, amongst other things, I was cutting and burning. And that was also why they felt they needed to hospitalize me. And as for so many people, it was labeled as a voluntary hospitalization. But I consider it my first involuntary hospitalization because they essentially said, well, you could voluntarily agree to go to the hospital to get treatment for this, or we can force you if you refuse. And so that was the choice that I was left with. So
you ended up in the hospital, even though it was a voluntary thing. It wasn't really a voluntary thing.
Right. And it didn't help. And I can say nobody asked me any questions. I engaged in all sorts of power struggles to try and get around the rules about phones and visitors and everything else. People looked at my arm to make sure my recent burn mark was not infected. But when I left that first hospitalization, you know, I basically had a doctor telling me, well, you need to stop doing this stuff for attention and then you'll have to come back. And that, in its way, maybe was more promising. He acted like I had some sort of control over my future, whereas others did not seem to think I did. But at the same time, it was another insult, another disinterested person not wanting to understand what was happening for me.
So here you are, someone who's, you know, obviously in a great deal of suffering. You're cutting yourself. You're burning yourself. What do you think you would have needed really to help you in that moment?
What made a difference over time was finding people who, even if what I was doing scared them, they didn't consider me less of a person. As a result, they weren't looking to lock me away. They were willing to sit with me and try to understand, try and ask questions, even if it was really hard. And if they still couldn't understand, still not looking to control me, but being with me.
What kinds of questions should they have asked, do you think?
Just a good, simple, you know, what does this mean to you or why do you do this would have been helpful, because I have answers to those questions. And I think even then I had answers to those questions.
What are the answers? I mean, is it the protection thing, the coping that you were talking about earlier?
I have used self-injury to help myself at various points in my life when I have felt so out of control of my physical surroundings, when I felt so out of control with my emotional pain. This was something that I could control, this physical pain, and that often felt almost as if it was releasing some of the emotional pain.
So the self-injury, in a sense, the pain of it kind of a little bit helped to reground you and get you out of that floaty kind of dissociative feeling.
Yes.
And the control part that you said before, it sounds like if you're trying to establish greater control, then losing control by being forced into the hospital is exactly the opposite of what you need. But the hospital didn't make you feel safer, even though you were physically prevented from burning or cutting yourself. You weren't really physically safer there.
I certainly didn't feel that way. I mean, I suppose arguments could be made by people looking from the outside in that perhaps there was some sense of safety, but I didn't feel it. And I've heard too many stories at this point of people who don't experience it that way. I heard someone share a story just recently of their own experience of having been hospitalized and quote-unquote kept safe for a year and a half in a hospital and then making the most serious suicide attempt that they'd ever made as soon as they were released because of how ultimately unsafe they had felt.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. Today, my guest is Sarah Davidow. Sarah is a psychiatric survivor. She's director of the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community, and she's co-producer of the new documentary film, Beyond the Medical Model. Sarah is a blogger on madinamerica.com, and we're going to be speaking today about psychiatric diagnosis and the politics of language. Who decides who's normal and who's crazy? Is it science or professional careers and pharmaceutical company profits? Join Rolling Stone and Harper's Magazine journalist Gary Greenberg, author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry, in dialogue with KBOO Madness Radio host Will Hall, Sunday, May 19th, 7:30 p.m. at Powell's Bookstore, Burnside. For more information, go to www.portlandhearingvoices.net.
No expression, no expression.
I think that's a really important research question. You know, does the experience of traumatization in hospital actually increase the risk of people hurting themselves or suicide or doing more destructive things to themselves? Because that's one of the consequences of trauma.
Right.
And how did you get out of the hospital and then start to move on with your life and start to get things back together for yourself?
With lots of stumbling points. I mean, I think that, you know, it can't be ignored that I come from a lot of privilege in that I have a family who's always had some access to wealth, and sometimes that has kept me outside of the view of the mental health system in the way that I think some haven't had the privilege of. So some of my worst moments, I was able to still pay rent and keep people away from me. So that certainly helped in my moving forward. Some of it was time. Some of it was ultimately, and though I don't recommend this either, getting pregnant and having a child who gave me a clear reason to need to keep moving forward. But there's just all these different stages and things that were happening at various points in my life that were helpful in my moving forward. And working was helpful too. And I kind of hid in the mental health system. I went and started working in the mental health system and really kept my own experiences at home.
So you became a staff person at mental health agencies doing work with people?
I did, yes. And, you know, it's interesting because I look back at those times, and in large part I think that I was trying to be aware of my experiences and use those in my work and do value-driven work with people. But there's also things where, you know, I think I sort of detached from that experience in the name of trying to pass in the general community and did things that I also would go back and do differently.
You were really hiding your hospital experience and your diagnosis and your whole past when you got these jobs and did that work as a mental health staff person.
I worked in one particular agency, and for the first 5 years, I was at a point in my life where I was not going into the hospital at that point. I was still struggling pretty dramatically, but I was not going into the hospital, so I was able to keep that job consistently. And for the first 5 years, I did not share with anybody what I had been through.
Was there a point at which you decided, now I'm going to start disclosing, now I'm going to be more open about who I am?
I did. I ended up taking a leave. My house had fallen apart. The pipes had burst. A number of things had happened that really just kind of pushed me over an edge. I was teetering on emotionally myself, and I really just needed to take some time to regroup. And so I took some time away from work, and I decided to, quote unquote, come out and start sharing my experiences. So myself and another person I was working with created this thing called the Staff Survivors Network that was specifically geared toward people who were both working in the system and had or were currently receiving services in that system.
And what was the response to that? I mean, were you able to continue to work in your job and be more open about who you were?
Not for long. I mean, I was there for a while after that, but things changed immediately. The moment that my story was out on the web, the funder started apparently talking to my supervisor at the organization and questioning whether or not I was competent to return to the work.
So they question your competency just because you disclosed that you had this history, not because of anything having to do with your workplace performance or anything like that?
For my prior 5 years in that position, I had been promoted. I had been told that clinically my work was above many people who had degrees that I did not have, and that our program was very successful. So yes, I would have to say that it was pretty directly tied to my having come out as someone who'd been diagnosed.
And what happened next?
I went through a process of being discredited, that things that would have not been questioned in the past or that I would have just been able to do without going through any number of hoops started to become much more difficult. People were watching. People were questioning on a daily basis. I was getting phone calls, or my supervisor was getting phone calls with questions or accusations, and it became so much harder to do my work. And frankly, I really burnt out just on the scrutiny of it.
And Sarah, if we were to step back for a moment, what do you think motivates them to go from praising you as a successful, competent worker who's doing really good work at levels above her degree level, who's responsible for the program being successful? What do you think motivates them to suddenly change that when you disclose your mental health history and now they are essentially trying to drive you out and it triggers you to file a complaint and this whole thing happens, then you end up getting fired? What do you think is really going on there?
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of fear and judgment that comes from this whole system that we've established around mental health and diagnosis. And I just have experienced in so many different ways, when you bring a diagnosis, when you bring these labels into any situation, people begin looking through these lenses. And it stops mattering what you say and what you do. People interpret in dramatically different ways, and it's based on fear. It's based on liability or perception of liability. I mean, you know, gosh, if I'm in a leadership position and I'm revealing these things and something bad happens, what might fall back on them? It just comes from, I think, really learned bias about what you should expect from people who have these diagnoses or who are, you know, one of the scariest things that I did share when I began opening up about this was the self-harm piece. So there's fears of suicide because people link those, although I don't think they should generally be linked. So there's a lot wrapped up in it.
We were talking earlier before the show about really this is a civil rights issue, and this is the moment where I think it becomes very clearly into view that this is systematic discrimination that happens, and there are very serious repercussions. And now you're in a very different place. You're not unemployed. You're actually the leader of one of the most innovative mental health programs run by people who are very open about their diagnosis, and the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community. How did you go from that sort of low point of getting kicked out of your previous mental health job to where you are now?
It wasn't so much about in one job I was the well person or the person pretending to be well, and here I just get to be out and quote unquote sick. That's not what it was about. It was about being able to be a whole person here with the challenges and the successes and the strengths and the places that I'm not as strong in, and just really getting to be a whole person.
Now the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community is a very thriving, and it really is a community. I mean, there's all kinds of different groups that are going on. It's an educational center. There are events, there are lectures, there are films that you guys are showing. There's all kinds of advocacy that happens. Tell us more about what it is that you're doing today and how you're making differences in people's lives.
The voice is really important. It continues. It was important at our roots, and it continues to be important. So many of the groups and things that we offer come out of what the community talks about looking for. So there's, for instance, the Hearing Voices movement work that we're doing. We are one of the relatively few organizations in the country right now that are doing that work, and we're offering trainings to other organizations who want to begin doing that work just in hopes to support some of the spreads. There's alternatives to suicide work that we're doing where people who have made suicide attempts or experienced feeling suicidal are leading groups and supporting one another who are, you know, struggling or have struggled in that way. And that's also really unusual in this country. Generally, the fear is that if you have experienced suicidal feelings, well, we better keep you away from other people who have experienced that, because we don't talk in that way. There's not peer support around this. It's too dangerous. It's generally the fear.
Whereas the reality is it's actually the opposite. If we don't talk about it, it's more dangerous.
Right. The fear that people experience in saying, you know, I'm having these feelings and being whisked out of their lives into the hospital is really powerful. And so the potential that can happen when you just talk about these experiences and talk about the alternatives without someone's finger being on the panic button is really important. And so that's what these spaces are about.
And you also have a group for formerly incarcerated people to provide peer support with each other.
So we have an after-incarceration support system group. So just like we value the experience of having been in the hospital or getting a psychiatric diagnosis, we also value the experience and the wisdom that comes from having been involved with the legal system or having been incarcerated. And so that's another really powerful group. We're about to start something called the Sylvia Rivera Peer Support Group, which is going to be around gender diversity and gender identity and different sexualities and experiences. So just many different types of opportunities to talk about where have we come from, what has happened to us, what is our experience. And I think that we do it in a very non-labeling way.
And this is really innovative work. It's happening there in Western Massachusetts. It's also happening in very tiny pockets around the country and around the world. But you're really showing the way, I think, where the system change needs to be going.
Absolutely. But I think it goes deeper than just having those connections or those shared experiences, too, because I perhaps have seen more people with the title of peer worker or peer specialist use power still in a negative way than I have seen it be positive. I mean, I think it can be tremendously positive, but it has to be more than the common experience, because there's something that happens, I think, perhaps it's around the loss of power that people experience when they're hospitalized, that when they do then find some success and find a role and find that that power is being handed to them through the name badge, through the access to keys and staff-only areas and all the rest of it, that there's a real risk, and often it actually comes to pass, that people take that power, and even in the peer role, are still having many of the same conversations that the traditional system is having. And so there has to be something that runs deeper. There has to be a shared value system. There has to be a recognition not only of our psychiatric labels and our lived experiences in that way, but of the experience of being oppressed and what that means and our impact and how to really create connections with people on a level playing field and not be a part of replicating the system.
So you're raising the broader issue, really, of the politics of language and how the words that we choose and the words that are used by institutions really shape experience and can control identities, in a sense.
Absolutely. If you think about it, so we have a number of different ways that language is used. We have the labels. We have the labels that go on the people who are receiving these services. And then we have all these words in the middle of how we describe people on either end. And so I think I've already said, as far as the labels that go on people, I think we have to be really cautious about how that can become someone's identity. I don't know that it's that healthy that someone moved through their entire life with the identity of consumer, that their identity is based on their struggles. And even if it's about their struggles of trying to move beyond the struggles, I'm not sure that that's the word that is healthy to move forward through, that it's also a personal choice. But I think then we get to the psychiatric labels. And so often that cuts off our genuine curiosity with people. And whether you're a clinician or you're in a peer role, it's so critical that we approach people to understand what's happening with them. And so giving someone a label with schizophrenia, or in my instance, borderline personality disorder, or any of these labels that are frankly these man-made creations that are used as part of a billing system, they don't tell us a lot about that person. And if, as so often happens in the system, we actually do try and figure out who that person is based on some of those labels, that can really cut off something important. So, you know, saying someone is schizophrenic tells you almost nothing. Saying that they hear voices, or asking them what the voices are saying, or, you know, any number of different kinds of conversations that can happen from a more genuine place are the points at which you actually learn about that person. And I think it's really hard for people to be helpful with one another if the genuine curiosity gets cut off.
Tell us about the new film that you are the co-producer of, Beyond the Medical Model.
So the film really connects for me. It's not about language per se, but it is about all these boxes that we put ourselves into. in that along with the language comes the different models, and the predominant model, the model that most people have heard of, often to the exclusion of any other model, is the medical model of mental illness. I think one of the key points in all of this, whether it's the language or the model's discussion, is that it's not that the medical model and some of its labels are inherently evil. It's that they've been given so much power so as to have become this oppressive force in our system that we see hurting people. And so this film is about not necessarily getting rid of it, but putting it on equal footing with all the other numbers of approaches and ways that people regard themselves. And so if someone has the opportunity to look at the different ways that people identify themselves and have found healing and choose from one or all of those different ways for themselves, then that's where we want to head.
Sarah Davidow, thank you for joining us on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Sarah Davidow. Sarah is a psychiatric survivor. She's the director of the Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Community and co-producer of the new documentary film Beyond the Medical Model, as well as being a blogger on madinamerica.com. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes.
Now for your KBOO News at Noon, I'm Jimmy Tardy. Egypt's tourism minister Hisham Zazu has announced that Egypt will allow alcohol and bikinis, at least in tourist areas. Before the forced removal of Hosni Mubarak 2 years ago, tourism was a $12 billion industry in Egypt. Recently, that has fallen to less than $9 billion a year. The moves by the tourism ministry are intended to restore some of the lost income. Libya's General National Congress has voted to prevent any former official from the regime of the late President Muammar Gaddafi from holding office. The Congress had been besieged by militias in favor of the law, who had stated that they would not leave their posts until the law was passed. The ruling affects the current Prime Minister and General National Congress Speaker. Prime Minister Ali Zaidan and Speaker Mohamed Magariaf had been diplomats before the revolution that swept Gaddafi from power. Human Rights Watch has criticized the measure, saying that it is too broad and could potentially bar anyone who worked for the authorities during the 4 decades of Gaddafi's rule. Along the border between India and China over the weekend, a standoff in the disputed Kashmir region has seen its first steps toward resolution. The area in question is known as the Line of Actual Control along the western edge of the border between the two countries. The border area has been disputed since China and India fought a war 50 years ago. Thousands of supporters of French leftist parties took to the streets of Paris on Sunday, shouting slogans such as "Down with austerity," "Out with finance, humans first," and "Austerity." The protesters gathered to express their disappointment with the first year of French President François Hollande's government, after having been elected on a platform promising to spare France from austerity measures such as those being imposed on Greece and Spain. Protesters say they are disappointed with the lack of action and that they are waiting for true leftist policies. Helmans Wiels, a prominent politician on the Dutch Caribbean island of Curaçao, was shot dead over the weekend. A longtime champion of Curaçao's independence from the Netherlands, Wiels hosted a radio program in which he discussed controversial issues affecting the nation of 150,000. Speaking out against corruption, 54-year-old Wiels had, on Friday, accused Curaçao's telecommunications company UTS of involvement in the illegal sale of lottery numbers. Mr. Wiels led the Pueblo Soberano Party, which won around a quarter of the votes in the 2012 election and holds a proportional number of seats on Curaçao's parliament. That's it for the KBOO News at Noon. For more local, national, and international news, tune in every evening at 5 for the KBOO Evening News. I'm Jimmy Tardy with the KBOO News Department. This is KBOO Portland.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time now for the Noontime Jamboree.
There ain't no lady gonna break my heart as long as I have my horse. No vamp can take the place of champ. A man's best friend is his horse. He never hollers for $10,000 and doesn't cause me remorse. There ain't no lady gonna break my heart as long as I have my horse. There ain't no lady gonna break my heart as long as I have my horse. No vamp can take the place of champ. A man's best friend is his horse. He never hollers for $10,000 and doesn't cause me remorse. There ain't no lady gonna break my heart as long as I have my horse. I hope she's listening. As long as I have my horse.
Well, starting off the Noontime Jamboree today with Gene Autry and As Long As I Have My Horse. I have two guests that are not horses here in the studio with me. Chris Tile and Dave Frischberger here. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, Retta.
I'm glad that you're here, and you each brought... Okay, my topic today is songs related to horses in honor of the Kentucky Derby. Chris, you brought in a few things.
Yeah, yesterday was the last day of the New Orleans Heritage Festival, what used to be called the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. But they thought that it would be better to just call it the New Orleans Heritage Festival. So anyway, I brought in a whole bunch of jazz from mostly...